The following statement is true. The preceding statement was false.
Hey, everybody, it's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. On this episode of Indirect Democracy, we'll be having a tribute to George Carlin and talking about marriage. Plus, get up a global warming update, 2 What Are We Awards, and you'll be hearing from different sponsors. Oh, man. Have I been gone that long that I forgot to mention we're going to have the President's Love Horoscope as well? I guess I have. But welcome. Welcome to podcast number 30 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. I am your host. My name is David. It's been a while, and I'm sorry it has taken as much time as it has, but I'm glad to be back. And as you may know, or if you are a fan and have listened before, Indirect Democracy is a very proud member of the Progressive Podcast Network. I encourage you to go to their website at progressivepodcastnetwork.org, or you can visit their forum site at newmediarevolutionaries.com. Now, as I mentioned before going into this show, this particular episode of Indirect Democracy is going to be very clip-heavy. There's going to be a lot, and if it's long, and I imagine it's going to be a very long episode of Indirect Democracy, I apologize and just ask you to stay there. It's going to include a lot of George Carlin stuff, plus we have a lot of clips that from the news that I just felt I could not cut due to their importance of what needed to be said. But I'm very glad to be back, and in getting ready to discuss different topics, I realized that there was a lot to talk about. I wanted to talk about Darfur. It's a very long topic in the making, but for the time being, until I get to that topic, I do encourage you to go to a website run by Maria Helena. There is a link to it on the favorite links section on the homepage for Indirect Democracy. I encourage you to visit that site. But modern day slavery, Darfur, the elections, everything that's been going on, there is a ton of stuff to talk about, and we're going to be getting into those over the next few months, especially getting into the election as it gets closer. I realized that with the passing of so many notables, and in particular George Carlin, that it would be impossible for me to have any type of podcast done without giving a tribute to the great man, the thinker, the legend, the one and only George Carlin. George Carlin, I imagine for a lot of people, myself included, was just a bright light of truth in a dark and shit-filled world. And I gotta tell you, when he passed, I was about as shocked as anybody, and I realized that I had to have a tribute to him on this particular episode. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play some clips, but I'm also going to explain and tell you that over the past few months I did prepare for and did get married. Very exciting news. I'll share that with you in a moment. But I thought I'd start out by just explaining my love of Carlin very, very quickly, which dealt with the very first album I ever bought of his. And I didn't buy one of the classic albums. I bought the Explicit Lyrics album. And there was a statement from Carlin that just shined for me. It was like an epiphany as to how words and language should be used and how they affect us. And here's that clip.
Because we do think in language. And so the quality of our thoughts and ideas can only be as good as the quality of our language.
You know, when I first heard that clip, it was like lightning struck. So you can understand how important that was for me, because now I started to really understand how language was put together, how it was given to us, what it gives us, what it feeds us, what it shares with us, what it takes away from us all at the same time. And I realized that there was so much more that had to be learned about language. And I gained that love, and I, you know, looked for that sort of type of guidance from Carlin, which I think many people did. But for me, that was the magical epiphany moment. It was the very first album I bought from him, that one simple statement. But as I mentioned, this is going to be a clip-heavy Carlin tribute. And as well, there's not really going to be a sponsor for this particular episode of Indirect Democracy. I put together different ideas, had a whole bunch of stuff, but realized that Carlin had some great sponsor stuff that I thought would be fun to run for this episode of Indirect Democracy. So I'm going to break every now and then to play some of those bits. But for now, I'm going to share with you this particular clip.
Have you ever been in a serious social situation when you suddenly realize you have to pull the underwear out of the crack in your ass?
You take this woman to be your lawful wedded wife.
Huh? Who, her? Oh, hell yeah.
Well, it's one of life's little moments, isn't it? It's one of those little moments you have to deal with at the time. You've got to get in there and clear that thing out. You've got to rescue your underwear. There's a letter in your mailbox.
I must have spent, like, moments frozen in time with the thought that that was going to happen to me. I had this image that I was going to be at the altar, and that was going to be my moment, with underwear about to creep up my ass. But that was not the moment, and hold on, let's get this ready, because I promised myself if I did talk about getting married and what that was like, that I would keep it to a particular time range. So here we go. Let's play some music. Very important.
There's just a few more hours, that's all the time you've got. A few more hours before they tie the knot.
There's drinks and girls all over London, and I got a
I know, sappy,
in just
stupid,
a few
silly,
more
but
hours.
So appropriate.
Shut up, me darling.
Because on a beautiful June morning, I did get married. I married my fiance of a few years now, and we've been together for 7 years. And it was a wonderful day. But the joke of it is that, you know, in moments like that, there's going to be that thing that goes wrong. And there were some things that did go wrong. Minimal things, nothing big. But the biggest thing of it all, and I'm sharing this with you because I feel like we know each other. Hi. Can I borrow some money? I'm just kidding. But it was a really great wedding. But the joke of it all, that thing that can go bad, the thing that can always go wrong and always does go wrong for a wedding, is that both Rachel and I were really sick for the wedding. I'm not talking about flu, vomit, or anything like that, because that would have been horrendous. But Rachel had bronchitis, and I caught a head cold that at one point had me sweating so badly, all I could think about was, you know, Nixon didn't sweat this much. And to add on to it, to the joy of getting ready for the wedding, is you don't think you're stressed. You think everything's going fine. You've planned out everything. And Sunday before the wedding, a blood vessel burst in my eye, which was great, because now it looked like I had low-grade ocular Ebola going on, so I'd spent like the week trying to get this red burst mass. It looked like I was the devil from going out, because I had this image of people going, oh, what nice photos. But everything did go very well, and you have to just be in awe of the whole situation, because it does go by like a blur. But there were months of planning, and it was like every weekend was spent doing something that was related for the wedding. Almost every night we spent talking about different issues, but everything just went by seamlessly and beautiful. And my favorite parts, and this is probably going to go a lot shorter than I thought, so I'm glad I'm not going to go through this entire 7-minute song. But I spent about 2 months working on a presentation, one of those slideshow, you know, oh, look, they're kids, aw, now he's a drunk adult, oh. But 2 months spent going through family photos, Rachel and I going through these things, putting everything together, finding the right music, getting the slideshow to work, finding the right program to put that together for me. And wow, what a pain in the butt for 10 minutes. But the overall plan for it was to get family members to cry. And I would like to say, unlike the president, mission accomplished. I accomplished what I needed to do. And there was no overhanging occupation. But we'll talk politics more in just a little bit. But it was a great wedding, and very happy about how everything went. And we're very excited.
Stab me and mail me,
but get me to the church on time.
For God's sake, get me to the church on time.
Okay, we're going to play another Carlin bit.
Well, I know some people don't like you to talk about those things. I know that. Some people don't like you to mention certain things. Some people don't want you to say this. Some people don't want you to say that. Some people think if you mention some things, they might happen. Some people are really fucking stupid. Did you ever notice that? How many really stupid people you run into during the day?
God damn, there's a lot of stupid bastards walking around. Carry a little pad and pencil with you. You wind up with 30 or 40 names by the end of the day. Look at it this way. Think of how stupid the average person is, and then realize half of them are stupider than that. And it doesn't take you very long to spot one of them, does it? Take you about 8 seconds. You'll be listening to some guy. You say, this guy is fucking stupid. Then there are some people, they're not stupid, they're full of shit. That doesn't take very long to spot either, does it? Take you about the same amount of time. You'll be listening to some guy and say, well, he's fairly intelligent. Ah, he's full of shit. Then there are some people, they're not stupid, they're not full of shit, they're fucking nuts! Dan Quayle is all three! All three! Stupid, full of shit, and fucking nuts! And where did he get that wife of his? Have you taken a good look at that Marilyn Quayle? Where did he get her? At a Halloween party or something? She looks like Prince Charles, for Christ's sakes. Let me ask you something. Does he actually have to fuck that woman? Huh? God help him. I wouldn't fuck her with a stolen dick. That's my political humor. People like it when you're topical.
Well, here it is. It is now, as I'm recording this, it is July 11th. I'm not going to go too much into other things about the wedding, but there was one thing I was thinking about, and that was Rachel and I spent a few days away, and we did go up north. We went to Monterey and to San Francisco, and we were in San Francisco the week before gay weddings were finally allowed up north. And it was really sort of, you could feel sort of an energy in the air about the place because flags were flying up all around City Hall. And, you know, of course, I don't know, I don't live in San Francisco, so maybe those flags are up a lot. But in being there, you could sense an excitement about what was about to occur. And here it is, July 11th. It's been about a few weeks since the very first weddings went into effect, almost a full month now, or almost a month and a half now since the California Supreme Court allowed gay marriages, saying that it was a violation of equal protection in the California Constitution not to allow them. And I have to say, woke up still very much in love with my wife. And I like saying those words, by the way, my wife. Nothing has changed. The world has not spun on its axis, it's still spun on its current axis. Nothing changed with how I feel about my wife. Nothing changed about how other people I know feel about their marriages. And I found myself just wondering again and again what it is that seems to scare people so much about the concept of, you know, gays being allowed to marry. It's probably the most conservative thing I can think of them being allowed to do, but people still freaking out about the idea of something that, when you think about it, when you woke up, and if you're married, is your life different? You know, did you feel any less about your spouse? Did you feel like your life was cheapened in some way, that, you know, the vows you took became meaningless? Because it got me thinking that if that's the case, you know, how strong were your vows to begin with? How strong were your feelings about that person that you're with? And nothing changed for me, and nothing changed for anybody else. And for the people that claim that it did change, well, then I think they have other issues they need to discuss. But it got me thinking a lot about the issue of gay marriage, and I'm sure you can hear my dog downstairs as he's barking away. And that one of the things I've always thought about when it comes to the issues of gay equality is that when it comes to protected classes, one of the things that is so obvious when you look at the protected classes, whether it be high scrutiny, middle scrutiny, and I'm sort of going over a little bit and discussing how protected classes are set up, is that all of them, I may have discussed this before in the past, deals essentially with, when you look at it constitutionally, a very biological set up into how people are protected. Race, ethnicity, sex, gender, whether or not somebody's adopted or illegitimate. But those are all very physical-based characteristics that define how those particular classes are protected. When you start to deal with issues regarding poverty, and even as the Supreme Court has put down for homosexuality, it's all based around something that is not biologically based. Now, for those of you who are progressive and listening, going, wait a minute, you know, homosexuality, give me a second, I'm working towards that. I think we all know that there are some people that we've met and had the fortune, you know, the good fortune of meeting family members that the second you meet them, you know, they know. It's pretty obvious to tell. And I've always had the belief that until somebody can have that true biological test, that it's going to be pretty damn close to impossible to get that protected status. Until you can have a biological thing that shows for sure, a DNA setup which shows that there's a different makeup, one that's reliable, one that people can look to, then you're going to have them say that, okay, there's a biological test that shows that this person is that, and maybe you can start looking at getting some of the protections that other, you know, ethnicities, classes, races have been able to get. But until that is set up, it's, like I said, pretty damn impossible to get the civil rights that should be necessary. And it's a very strange classification that's set up, because when you look at the concept of marriage and marriage alone, civil unions, of course, are that contractual basis given by the state, city government, whichever it is, that allows for people to have that marriage. Marriage itself, when you're looking at the words themselves, you know, connotate more of a religious connotation to it. So it's understandable that if a church didn't want to marry somebody, that you would have that particular religious sect could say no, and that would be fine because of our freedom of religious expression. And looking at the Constitution, how it's set up, the fact that marriage, if you're gay, isn't protected by the full faith and credit clause is stunning. That if you were to get a civil judgment somewhere within the state of California, it could be enforced in other states because of the full faith and credit clause. You look at things where if somebody is, you know, being sought criminally, different agencies are going to understand and respect what that state is doing, or that particular, or, you know, county or city, to get that person back. If you're looking at the contracts clause alone, the ability of the state to impair a contractual right is not allowed by the Constitution, but these laws can be passed which will affect gay marriages and say that once they've been taken place, the current law that's being proposed in California would nullify the marriages that have occurred or are about to occur between June 17th and November, I believe it's the 4th. So it's a weird thing to look at. And what makes it stranger is that there was a case in Oklahoma, and let me get that case for you, because I want to be sure to quote this to you properly. Okay, the name of this case was Finston v. Crutcher. And what it dealt with were the rights and the abilities of gay couples to be allowed to get adoption orders that were recognized by the state of Oklahoma. And in this particular case, Dr. Crutcher was sued in his official capacity as the Commissioner of Health for Oklahoma regarding a judgment that a state law barred the recognition of adoptions by same-sex couples already finalized in another state. The court in this particular case held that final adoption orders by a state court of competent jurisdiction are judgments that must be given full faith and credit under the Constitution by every other state in the nation. Now, and this shocked me because this was an Oklahoma court. Because the Oklahoma statute at issue categorically rejects a class of out-of-state adoption decrees, it violates the full faith and credit clause. We therefore affirm the order and judgment of the district court declaring the statute unconstitutional and directing the issuance of new birth certificates. But I bring this case up in particular because of the importance of a state, Oklahoma of all states, recognizing the importance of the full faith and credit clause when it deals with homosexuality and orders that are given in by a state agency. So I think that's where a ray of light starts to shine, but it's one that's going to take a long time, because in thinking about this biological thing, that's this standard that seems to be set within constitutional law, the one thing that I don't think anybody factors in and doesn't really want to mention and won't discuss is the true biological factor, and you have to call it that because of how important it is. It's love. It's It's that biological response you have to that other person that makes you feel alive and stronger, and what emotion can do to a person, especially in cases where that person is gone and you can't have them there, and how it wrenches the body's soul and it feels like something actually breaks inside of you. And that physical test has never been put into it. It's just sort of a given. But I thought about that in particular because of a couple of friends of mine. One of them is moving back into the California area. He is gay. He's been in a long-term relationship, and was talking with a friend of mine who had seen him and asked how he was, how his partner was, and asked if they were going to be getting married. And the response from my friend who told me about this one particular person was, no, they weren't going to get married because they were afraid of what the state could possibly do in November and what it would mean to them if it was taken away. And that pretty much, you know, just sort of floored me, because you don't think about that. These sort of givens you get, that when you love somebody and you're committed to them and everything you want with them, and to have it said that, no, they're not going to take that step, a truly conservative step, that it could be taken away from them, it was really just an eye-opening statement. And one that I think we should all think about is just, in the end, how does it truly affect your life? Because if the only way it affects your life is just to get across a talking point or an emotional mean point to say they shouldn't have that because, then maybe you're missing the point of what love means. And now our first sponsor ad.
Say, why not become a schmuck? A licensed practicing schmuck. Or, if you qualify, a CPS. That's right, a certified public schmuck. You know, it may not seem like it when you look around, but there is a shortage of schmucks in today's society. And there's big money in schmuckdom. The average schmuck today earns over $34,000 a year. And there are openings for schmucks in virtually every field. The government is run by schmucks, big business is run by schmucks, and more, people are becoming schmucks on their own. You know, some guys can only manage to be schmucks on New Year's Eve, but here's your opportunity to become a full-time, year-round schmuck. Give us a call. Don't be a schmuck. Be a schmuck.
Okay, usually going into any podcast, I will bring up the global warming update. Now, I kind of skipped that this time, but I am going to bring up a story. I found several different stories, some lighthearted, some that were, you know, a little bit more serious, and I was getting ready to read a couple of them. But this one in particular bothered me because it came out today, Friday, July 11th. This is from MSNBC News. The title is Bush Sidesteps Court Ruling on Warming. Washington. The Bush administration on Friday rejected regulating greenhouse gases blamed for global warming, saying it would cause too many job losses. In a 588-page federal notice, the EPA, or the Environmental Protection Agency, made no finding on whether global warming poses a threat to people's health, reversing an earlier conclusion at the insistence of the White House and officially kicking any decision on a solution to the next president and Congress. EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson insisted that regulating greenhouse gases via the Clean Air Act was not workable. Quote, if our nation is truly about serious regulating greenhouse gases, the Clean Air Act is the wrong tool for the job, Johnson told reporters. It's really at the feet of Congress. The White House on Tuesday rejected EPA's conclusion 3 weeks earlier that the 1970 Clean Air Act can be both workable and effective for addressing global climate change. Instead, EPA said Friday that law is ill-suited. Obviously that the law is ill-suited for dealing with climate change. This contrasts sharply with the tone of statements President Bush made at the just-concluded G8 summit of leading industrialized nations in Japan. The United States at that meeting joined other summit partners in embracing a policy declaration to seek a 50% reduction in global greenhouse gases by 2050. In a major setback to the administration, the Supreme Court ruled last year that the government has authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases as a pollutant. Bush has consistently opposed that option. In a continuation of the story, one point is clear. The potential regulation of greenhouse gases under any portion of the Clean Air Act could result in an unprecedented expansion of EPA authority that would have a profound effect on virtually every sector of the economy and touch every household in the land, the EPA's Johnson said in the preface to the federal notice. Activists were quick to criticize the EPA's move. The administration needs to stop passing the buck and start regulating dangerous greenhouse gases, Kieran Suckling, executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity, said in a statement. The decisions we make today will not only determine whether the polar bear and thousands of other species will be driven extinct by global warming, they will determine whether human health and the economy will be wracked by dangerous climate change. Suckling noted that in December 2007, then EPA Associate Deputy Administrator Jason Burnett transmitted a draft finding to the White House concluding that greenhouse gases threatened public welfare. Burnett, a Democrat, resigned last June, citing differences with the administration's climate policy. Representative Edward Markey, chairman of the House Select Committee on Global Warming, called the administration's findings the bureaucratic equivalent of saying that the dog ate your homework. You know, I'm really just going to make this very quick as to what I have to say, but for the government to come back and to say that a congressional act filed under the Clean Air Act and by the Environmental Protection Agency was holed up, found by the Supreme Court last year, was that they had the ability to regulate greenhouse gases, and say that they don't is just pathetic and sad. This is what that agency is for. This is what Congress set it up for. Congress, under its powers under the Commerce Clause, allowed this ability to occur because it has to be taken care of, because global warming and climate change will affect our economy, will affect the ability for this country to produce everything from food to gas to have roads where it's supposed to can go up and drill for oil in Antwerp, but they can't because the roads are only usable for 3 months out of the year because the permafrost is melting. To say that there is no economic impact that is going to be greater than what we're possibly going to suffer through is just ridiculous for this government to say, because they don't want to lose jobs now. I have always said from the beginning, believe it or not, have a feeling, say, I'm not sure if global climate change is true or not, but to seek out and follow the policies that could possibly get us towards an energy policy and an economy that works off of alternative fuels and other energy bases, which could be so much more viable and helpful to the planet and its environment, and could get us off our dependency for foreign oil, would be a boon to this economy, would put in new jobs, get new people involved, new industries, could be a boon to the economy and growth. We could become the global leader on these things. But for some reason, they can't get past protecting the current jobs, the status quo, what greases the wheels now. And that is where the sad truth of it all lies, is that they do not want to lose the money that they're getting now. And that is why they fight global climate change so strongly. And while there are so many different stories to talk about how to be more eco-pet friendly and all those types of things, I encourage you to find those stories on your own. There's a nice little link at the bottom of the homepage for Indirect Democracy. It has a little feeder there. It tells you all types of great stories about global climate change and how it affects our lives. But I do encourage you strongly to read a Newsweek article that I will post online in the research links entitled, let me get this for you. This is a Newsweek story entitled, Global Warming is the Cause of This Year's Extreme Weather. It is time to start doing all we can to mitigate the damage caused by global climate change. And now, after talking about global climate change, I'm going to play this particular Carlin bit that deals with the planet.
We're so self-important. So self-important. Everybody's going to save something now. Save the trees. Save the bees. Save the whales. Save those snails. And the greatest arrogance of all, save the planet. What? Are these fucking people kidding me? Save the planet? We don't even know how to take care of ourselves yet. We haven't learned how to care for one another. We're going to save the fucking planet? I'm getting tired of that shit. Tired of that shit. I'm tired of fucking Earth Day. I'm tired of these self-righteous environmentalists, these white bourgeois liberals who think the only thing wrong with this country is there aren't enough bicycle paths. People trying to make the world safe for their Volvos. Besides, environmentalists don't give a shit about the planet. They don't care about the planet. Not in the abstract, they don't. Not in the abstract, they don't. You know what they're interested in? A clean place to live. Their own habitat. They're worried that someday in the future they might be personally inconvenienced. Narrow, unenlightened self-interest doesn't impress me. Besides, there is nothing wrong with the planet. Nothing wrong with the planet. The planet is fine. The people are fucked. Difference. Difference. The planet is fine.
compared to the people, the planet is doing great. It's been here 4.5 billion years. Do you ever think about the arithmetic? Planet has been here 4.5 billion years. We've been here, what, 100,000? Maybe 200,000? And we've only been engaged in heavy industry for a little over 200 years. 200 years versus 4.5 billion. And we have the conceit to think that somehow we're a threat? That somehow we're going to put in jeopardy this beautiful little blue-green ball that's just a-floating around the sun? The planet has been through a lot worse than us. Been through all kinds of things worse than us. Been through earthquakes, volcanoes, plate tectonics, continental drift, solar flares, sunspots, magnetic storms, the magnetic reversal of the poles, hundreds of thousands of years of bombardment by comets and asteroids and meteors, worldwide floods, tidal waves, worldwide fires, erosion, cosmic rays, recurring ice ages, and we think some plastic bags and some aluminum cans are going to make a difference? The planet isn't going anywhere. We are. We're going away. Pack your shit, folks. We're going away. And we won't leave much of a trace either. Thank God for that. Maybe a little styrofoam. Maybe. Little styrofoam. Planet will be here and we'll be long gone. Just another failed mutation. Just another closed-end biological mistake. An evolutionary cul-de-sac. The planet will shake us off like a bad case of fleas. A surface nuisance. You want to know how the planet's doing? Ask those people at Pompeii who are frozen into position from volcanic ash. How the planet's doing. Want to know if the planet's all right? Ask those people in Mexico City or Armenia or 100 other places buried under thousands of tons of earthquake rubble if they feel like a threat to the planet this week. How about those people in Kilauea, Hawaii, who build their homes right next to an active volcano and then wonder why they have lava in the living room? The planet will be here for a long, long, long time after we're gone, and it will heal itself, it will cleanse itself, because that's what it does. It's a self-correcting system. The air and the water will recover, the earth will be renewed, and if it's true that plastic is not degradable, well, the planet will simply incorporate plastic into a new paradigm, the earth plus plastic. The earth doesn't share our prejudice towards plastic. Plastic came out of the Earth. The Earth probably sees plastic as just another one of its children. Could be the only reason the Earth allowed us to be spawned from it in the first place. It wanted plastic for itself. Didn't know how to make it. Needed us. Could be the answer to our age-old egocentric philosophical question, why are we here? Plastic. Asshole. So, the plastic is here. Our job is done. We can be phased out now. And I think that's begun. Don't you think that's already started? I think, to be fair, the planet sees us as a mild threat, something to be dealt with, and the planet can defend itself in an organized, collective way, the way a beehive or an ant colony can, a collective defense mechanism. The planet will think of something. What would you do if you were the planet? How would you defend yourself against this troublesome, pesky species? Let's see, viruses. Viruses might be good. They seem vulnerable to viruses. And viruses are tricky, always mutating and forming new strains whenever a vaccine is developed. Perhaps this first virus could be one that compromises the immune system of these creatures. Perhaps a human immunodeficiency virus, making them vulnerable to all sorts of other diseases and infections that might come along. And maybe it could be spread sexually, making them a little reluctant to engage in the act of reproduction. Well, that's a poetic note. And it's a start. And I can dream, can't I?
Well, now it's time to get into a different part of the program. It is time for the President's Love Horoscope. And before I can read you that, I need to bring up the very perfect music for that. Oh yeah. There it is. Oh yeah.
Feels so good.
Now, in an effort to help out the president and everything he's going through, we give out the president's love horoscope. And as we know, our president is a Cancer. So, for the week of July 7th through the 13th, here is your presidential love horoscope.
I love you, baby.
A colleague or partner may insist that additional travel is required to hit a goal or make a sale. Now, this same person may want to change the way contracts and payroll decisions are executed. But you're not comfortable with either of these propositions right now. Wait a minute, I think I brought up the wrong horoscope. Wait a minute, this is his career horoscope. Okay. Now what the hell, just keep reading it. You're less inclined to want to cover the globe. But since it's a love horoscope, grab onto those globes, President Bush. And you may have had your fill of living out of a suitcase. You need to get your fill in, President Bush. But you also don't understand why suddenly contracts or payroll needs to be reinvented. Nothing wrong with learning something new, Mr. President. But you're starting to feel pushed by that friend or colleague or partner. And each time you feel pressured, you hide a little deeper in your shell. It appears that what you really need right now is some sort of guarantee that everything will be all right. And your weekly touchstones, President Bush, for your career demented love horoscope. Your weekly touchstones are emerald and black opal. And that is your love horoscope. Well, that didn't work out the way I wanted to, but what the hell. Okay, now it's time for another Carlin bit.
I love words. I thank you for hearing my words. I want to tell you something about words that I think is important. I love, as I say, they're my work, they're my play, they're my passion. Words are all we have, really. We have thoughts, but thoughts are fluid, you know. And then we assign a word to a thought. And we're stuck with that word for that thought. So be careful with words. I like to think, yeah, the same words, you know, that hurt can heal. It's a matter of how you pick them. There are some people that aren't into all the words. There are some people that would have you not use certain words. Yeah, there are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7. They must really be bad. They'd have to be outrageous to be separated from a group that large. All of you over here, you 7. Bad word. That's what they told us they were, remember? That's a bad word. No bad words. Bad thoughts. Bad intentions. And words. You know the 7, don't you, that you can't say on television? Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. Huh? Those are the heavy 7. Those are the ones that'll infect your soul, curve your spine, and keep the country from winning the war. Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. Wow. And tits doesn't even belong on the list, you know? Yeah. It's such a friendly-sounding word. Sounds like a nickname, right? Hey, tits, come here, man. Hey, tits. Hey. Hey, tits, meet toots. Toots, tits, toots, toots, man. Sounds like a snack, doesn't it, huh? Yeah. Yes, I know, it is, right, a snack. But I don't mean your sexist snack. I mean new Nabisco tits. The new cheese tits. Corn tits and pizza tits and sesame tits, onion tits, tater tits. Yeah. Bet you can't eat just one. Huh? That's true. I usually switch off. But, I mean, that word does not belong on the list. Actually, none of the words belong on the list. But you can understand why some of them are there. I mean, I'm not completely insensitive to people's feelings. You know, I can dig why some of those words got on the list. Like cocksucker and motherfucker. Those are heavyweight words, you know. Oh, there's a lot going on there, man. Besides the literal translation and the emotional feeling, I mean, they're just busy words. There's a lot of syllables to contend with. And those K's, those are aggressive sounds. They jump out at you, man. Cocksucker, motherfucker, cocksucker. It's like an assault on you, you know? So I can dig that. Now, we mentioned shit earlier, of course, and two of the other four-letter Anglo-Saxon words are piss and cunt, which go together, of course, but forget that. Little accidental humor I throw there. Piss and cunt. The reason that piss and cunt are on the list is that a long time ago, certain ladies said, those are the two I'm not going to say. I don't mind fucking shit, but P and C are out. P and C are out. Which led to such stupid sentences as, okay, you fuckers, I'm going to tinkle now. And, of course, the word fuck. The word fuck. I don't really... Well, here's some more accidental humor. I don't really want to get into that now. Because I think it takes too long. But I do mean that. I mean, I think the word fuck is a very important word. It's the beginning of life, and yet it's a word we use to hurt one another quite often. And, people much wiser than I have said, I'd rather have my son watch a film with two people making love than two people trying to kill one another. And I, of course, can agree. It's a great sentiment. I wish I knew who said it first, and I agree with that. But I'd like to take it a step further. I'd like to substitute the word fuck for the word kill in all those movie cliches we grew up with, right?
Okay, Sheriff, we're gonna fuck you now. But we're gonna fuck you slow.
So maybe next year I'll have a whole fucking rap on that word. I hope so. There are two-way words. Those are the seven you can never say on television. Under any circumstances, you just cannot say them. Ever, 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 not even clinically. You cannot weave them in on the panel with Doc and Ed and Johnny. I mean, it's just impossible. Forget those seven. They're out. But there are some two-way words, those double-meaning words. Remember the ones you giggled at in sixth grade? And the cock crowed three times.
Hey, the cock crowed three times. Hey, it's in the Bible.
There are some two-way words, like it's okay for Kurt Gowdy to say, Roberto Clemente has two balls on him. But he can't say, I think he hurt his balls on that play, Tony, don't you? He's holding them. He must have hurt them, by God. And the other two-way word that goes with that one is prick. It's okay if it happens to your finger. Yes, you can prick your finger, but don't finger your prick. No, no.
Now, because it is important, I would like to take a little bit of time out to say hi. How you doing? Just need a little bit of a break there. A voice break before we get into an ad by the Progressive Podcast Network.
All I'm saying is give peace a chance.
Wake up.
It's time to take to the street.
Mainstream media, where are you?
George W. Bush was born on third base, but thinks he hit a triple.
WakeUpAM.blogspot.com.
All the oil men in the White House.
Rumsfeld's cronies, buddies, neocon pals.
What is wrong with this picture?
It just bypasses whatever's in the Constitution.
Just when we think it can't get any worse.
Fascist government.
dictatorship.
He's like the ultimate spoiled brat.
Wake up and smell the oil fields.
Remember who said that.
This isn't health care.
This is get sick and die care.
Mainstream media doesn't cover it, so that's why we're here.
Yeah, look for me at Gitmo. That's where I'll be.
After September
11th. Playing the 9/11 card every time
they American subject to eavesdropping.
These actions are within the president's authority under the Constitution.
It's ridiculous.
Laws.
What do they have to
It's poo-poo.
Wakeupam.blogspot.com.
I dare anyone to call me a conspiracy theorist.
Okay, now, as I stated, I'm going to have a What a Weenie Award, and I'm actually going to have a couple of them, and I'm going to get into the first one right now. Now, I'm going to read you a story, and what I'm also going to do is play for you this entire clip. I think it's important. And this story deals with Joe Horn. Now, Joe Horn was a 62-year-old man who shot down two burglars who broke into his neighbor's house. And just this past June was cleared by a grand jury of shooting those two particular burglars. He shot burglars, not burgers, because burgers would be weird. I don't know, it's Texas. You could shoot burgers. I don't know. They have weird laws over there. But here's the title of that story. Joe Horn cleared by a grand jury in Pasadena shootings. A Harris County grand jury on Monday ended the rancorous 7-month debate over Pasadena resident Joe Horn's decision to gun down two illegal immigrant burglars in his front yard, concluding that the act was justifiable use of deadly force and not murder. The grand jury heard 2 weeks of testimony from witnesses, including Horn. They likely also heard his breathless 911 call, during which the increasingly frustrated retiree ignored a dispatcher's pleas to stay inside and out of harm's way. The November 14 call ended with the sound of Horn racking a shell into his 12-gauge shotgun's chamber, followed by three gunshots that killed Colombians Diego Ortiz, 30, and Hernando Riascos Torres, 38. Each man was shot in the back. They had taken about $2,000 in the burglary. Horn's defense hinged on his assertions that he fired out of fear for his life, making the shooting justifiable under Texas law, the Castle Law. The law also permits the use of deadly force to protect property under some circumstances. In his 911 call, Horn cited a newly enacted Texas law, the Castle Doctrine, which authorizes the use of deadly force during a home invasion. But Senator Jeff Wentworth, who wrote the law, said it did not apply to Horn's case. He said the Castle Doctrine simply didn't apply because although the burglars were running across Horn's lawn, Horn's home wasn't under siege. His neighbor's home was. Now, during the shooting, and this is from the story, authorities have said one man ran toward Horn but had angled away toward the street when he was shot in the back just before reaching the curb. Now, because I think it's important, what I have found is the entire 911 call, and I'm going to play it for you now so you can make up your own mind as to what occurred during that day.
Pasadena 911, what is your emergency?
Burglars breaking into a house next door.
What's the address there, sir?
7418. Not my address, but next door, okay?
Yes, sir. 7418 what, sir?
Timberline Drive. I've got a shotgun. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to stop him?
Nope. Don't do that. Ain't no property worth shooting somebody over, okay?
Well, they're breaking in right now. They're in their house.
Mm-hmm.
I'm watching them.
What color is the house they're breaking into?
It's kind of a red brick right next to a two-story brick home, my home.
All right. What's the... guys look like white, black, Hispanics?
They're black, two of them.
Two black males? What are they wearing?
One's kind of a green shirt and white tennis shoes and blue jeans, and both of them are in the house right now.
What's the other one wearing, sir?
I didn't get a look at the other one.
What's your last name, sir?
Horn, Joe Horn, H-O-R-N.
Joe, what is your phone number, please?
This is my cell phone, 713-819-9826.
And you're at what address, please?
I'm at 7418 Timberline. They are next door.
Do you know that number next door?
I don't know if it's ascending or descending. But hurry up, man. Catch these guys, will you? Because I ain't going to let them go. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not going to let them go. I'm not going to let them get away with this shit.
Okay, hold on.
Now, if you're standing in front of my house, okay, looking at it from the street, it'll be the left-hand house. You got that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Stay on the phone with me till we get someone right over there, okay? Don't hang up.
I'm not hanging up, but I'm telling you right now, I don't like this kind of stuff, man. This is ridiculous.
Yes, sir, it is.
Broad daylight. I don't know if they're armed or not. I know they got a crowbar because that's what they broke in the windows with.
Which window did they go through?
The side, on the side where the gate is. I mean, you know, where the fence is because nobody can see them. That would be the right-hand side. looking from the front. Man, this is scary. I can't believe this is happening in this neighborhood.
What?
This is scary. I can't believe this would happen in this neighborhood.
Inside the house, the guy's got a shotgun. If we don't get there, he's going to go shoot their ass. Yeah.
Can you see anything at all?
No, I just see where they went in the house. I can't see in the house.
I understand that, but you can see where they entered in?
Yes.
So they might slip out the same way, or can you see the front of the house?
I can't see the front. I can go out the front, but if I go out the front, I'm bringing a shotgun with me, I swear to God.
Oh, no.
I'm not going to let them get away with it. I can't take a chance on getting killed over this, okay?
No.
I'm going to shoot. I'm going to shoot.
Stay inside the house and don't go out there, okay? I know you're pissed off, and I know what you're feeling, but it's not worth shooting someone over this, okay?
I don't want to, but I mean, if I go out there, to see what the hell's going on, I mean, what thoughts am I going to have?
No, I don't want you to go out there. I asked if you could see anything out there, if you could see.
I can see a little bit of the driveway, but see, I can't see the front.
Can you see anything out in the front of the house, that, like a vehicle they came in or anything?
No.
Let me know if you see anything at all from where you're at. Don't go outside, okay? Stay in the house. Mr. Horn is still there?
I'm here.
All right.
Don't do no good. Don't let go of it, and if he goes outside, he's going to shoot him. He's very adamant about
that. I'm going to tell you when I've got officers on the scene out there.
Not yet, you don't.
No, I know.
I can't see the front of the house. I can't tell if they stole something or getting away or not.
That's all right. Ain't nobody home that you know of, is there?
Well, over there, I would assume. I hope not.
Okay. I mean, you know your neighbors?
No, I really don't know these neighbors. I know the neighbors on the other side really well. I can assure you, if it had been their house, I'd already done something.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know them really well,
Mr. Horn?
Yes?
Why don't you listen to me carefully, okay?
Yes.
I've got officers coming out there. I don't want you to go outside of that house. And I don't want you to have that gun in your hand when those officers are poking around over there. Okay?
I understand that, but I have a right to protect myself too, sir, and
yes,
you understand
you
that.
Yes,
and the laws have been changed in this country since September the 1st, and you know it and I know it.
I
have a right to protect myself.
I'm right there.
And a shotgun is a legal weapon. It's not an illegal weapon.
No, it's not. I'm not saying that. Not wanting you to,
Okay, he's coming out the window right now. I got to go, buddy. I'm sorry, but he's coming out the window.
Don't go out the door. Mr. Horn? Mr. Horn?
God damn it, they just stole something. I'm going out the window.
Don't,
I'm sorry. I ain't let them get away with this shit. They stole something. They got a bag of something.
The house.
I'm doing it.
Mr. Horn, do not
I'm
go
sorry.
Outside the house.
This ain't right, buddy.
You're going to get yourself shot if you go outside that house with a gun.
You want to make a
what
bet?
You think. Okay, stay in the house.
They weren't getting away.
That's all right. Property's not worth killing someone over. Okay?
God damn it.
Don't go out the house. Don't be shooting nobody. I know you're pissed and you're frustrated, but don't do it.
They got a bag of loot.
Okay. How big is the bag? They're carrying
a
bag
of
stuff. They're walking out about a hand up.
Yeah.
Which way are they going?
I can't. I'm going outside. I'll find out.
No, I don't want you going outside, Mr. Horn.
Well, here it goes, buddy. You hear the shotgun clicking, and I'm going.
Don't go outside.
No, you're dead. Get the law over here quick. Get one of them's in the front yard over there. He's down. The other one's run down the street.
I had
no choice. They came in the front yard with me, man.
I had no choice.
I'm a 7418 Timberline. Get somebody over here quick, man.
All right, Mr. Horn, are you out there right now?
No, I am inside the house. I went back in the house, man. They come right in my yard. I didn't know what the shit they was going to do.
Shoot somebody, Mr. Horn?
Yes, I did.
Where are you right now?
I'm inside the house.
You're inside 7418.
Please, you're out here right now.
Mr. Horn, put that gun down before you shoot an officer of mine. I've got several officers out there without uniforms on.
I am in the front yard right now.
Put that gun down. There's officers out there without uniforms on. Do not shoot anybody else. Do you understand me?
I understand.
I've got police officers out there that
I am
do not
out
have
out the front
officers.
Yard waving my hand right now.
You don't have a gun with you, do you?
No.
You see a uniformed officer?
Hey, lay down on the ground and don't do nothing else.
No.
Lay down on the ground, Mr. Horn. Do what the officers tell you to do right now.
Come on, dude. Where's the gun?
In the house.
Where?
In the chair.
Now, the thing that amazes me about this grand jury decision, this is why they're the winners of the very first What a Weenie Award, is that when you listen to Joe Horn, from the very beginning, he is warned repeatedly not to go outside. He is warned that he should have nothing to do with this event, but you can hear the anger that flows through this man's voice. There was no way in any shape or form those people were about to break into his house. They weren't going into his house. They weren't about to get anywhere near his home, except for apparently when they crossed the lawn. But Joe Horn took the law into his own hands. Simple, straightforward vigilantism. You cannot put it any other way. And it is not his job to take the law into his own hands. But even if you were to look at the situation, maybe we weren't there. Maybe when he went out there, he was all full of piss and vinegar, and he was going to protect his property or protect his neighbor's property. The authorities say that at one point, those people were on his lawn, and we don't know, because we only know from what was released in the news facts and what comes out from the police officer that was there on scene. We don't know that maybe one of these burglars did try to make a move towards Mr. Horn. And at that point, of course, this is where the facts come into play and is put into the apprehension into one's mind. But in self-defense comes the belief that you had an imminent fear or apprehension for the safety of yourself. Mr. Horn didn't even have anywhere close to that until he stepped outside with that shotgun, and at all times was warned not to step outside and had no reason to step outside. He'd already called the police. The police were on the scene, and he still went out there and took the law into his own hands. Now, leaving that alone in that little vacuum that I'm discussing, the possibility that maybe one of the burglars could have turned around and done something. But at the same time, the facts show that both of these men were shot, at least in part, for the most part, in the back, one of them at a different angle. So maybe he turned around, saw what was happening, and was shot, but still got shot in the back. These men were retreating away from the area. He was still cleared. And the thing that comes over and you cannot escape is when you look at the facts, the subtle facts that nobody really wants to talk about, is that the burglars were illegal immigrants, Colombians. As you just heard in the tape, he described them as being black. He was so interested in protecting his neighbor's property, but he didn't even know his neighbors. And from the news reports that are coming out, he didn't take the time to get to know his neighbor, the one he was so interested in protecting, who was Vietnamese. There is a subtle air of racism that exists within this grand jury finding, because when you look at it, here's a man who shot illegal immigrants in Texas, a hotbed issue, if you will, and you have a man who didn't even take the time to know his neighbor who was so interested in protecting. To not say that racism exists within this decision is to be blind and foolish as to what occurred when the grand jury refused to indict Joe Horn. Because when you listen to it and just keep it on that vacuumed level, not knowing who those people were, you listen to his voice. He was going to kill somebody. It didn't matter who said what or who did what. The man went out to kill people. And that is why, with racism also in mind, that is why the Harris Grand Jury wins this very first What a Weenie Award. And now here are some more sponsor ads from George Carlin.
Here are some notes of community interest. The Elderly Dykes Home is sponsoring their annual Tits for Tots campaign. Tonight they will be presenting a slideshow entitled The Great Cabbage Fart Panic of 1860. St. Anthony's Home for the Occasionally Coherent is holding a staring contest tonight with the proceeds to benefit the Dead People's Olympics. This Sunday, don't miss Issues and Assholes, an in-depth look at questions of public interest. This weekend, should there be gay smoking areas? Then relax as sex and sports get together on Bowling for Pussy.
Okay, one of the big things that's been going on is that everybody's been accusing Barack Obama of shifting to the center to appeal to more independents through his FISA vote and through faith-based initiatives to gain more votes out there. And, of course, that is pissing off a good amount of the left base that wants him to basically be Denis Kucinich. Well, sorry, people. Just wasn't going to happen that way. If you wanted Denis Kucinich, you should have voted for Denis Kucinich. But you didn't. You fell in love with the other guy, and now you're upset a little bit because he isn't doing everything that you thought he was going to do, even though he said from way before that he was going to do the very things that he's doing right now. Now, suffice it to say, he said he was going to filibuster the part about telecom immunity, and he didn't, and that was disappointing all to itself. But in thinking about what Barack Obama did recently, I found myself talking to a friend, and of course she was a little bit upset about it, and the only thing I could think of to just sort of get her to calm down was to talk about what it really means. I think we've all known from before, if you read Audacity of Hope and if you knew his stances on community organization, that he was going to lean more towards faith-based initiatives to try to get things done within the inner city and with other projects, because he's done that. That's been his history. He knows they work. He's seen them work. He's going to lean towards that direction. So that should have been of no surprise to anybody. FISA was highly disappointing. There is no way to say that what happened with FISA wasn't anything but the Democratic left kowtowing to the Republicans, giving them their final real true victory. And it is disturbing. There's just no getting around it. They all caved in. The ones that voted for it caved in completely. But as I was mentioning to this friend, I said, you know what? We fell in love with the guy. This is what we're going to do. We're going to marry this guy, for lack of a better word, and don't mean to bring up the words too much, but this is the guy we're sticking with. This is the guy we're going to go with. And right now, he knows as well as I do that you have to win the independents. Nobody is going to win this on their base alone. McCain's not going to win it on the base. He doesn't have much of a base. Obama's not going to win it on the base because that's where people are going to feel disenfranchised. They're going to go, well, they're going to get fed information from, it's like news networks like Fox and CNN and MSNBC. And I don't mean to say this in a bad way because I do watch MSNBC all the time. But they're going to focus on what they feel middle America clings to. And there's nothing wrong with clinging to the values that middle America sticks to, because we have to unite as a country to fix these problems. And that is where this man is working towards. I would like to say that he is really being honest about this. This is how he is. But I'm too much of a cynic to not believe or understand or realize that somewhere along the line you have to play the game. It's why he's wearing a lapel pin. But what does it matter? You can wear lapel pins on every shirt jacket. They're still going to find ways to say it. There's always going to be the little subtle things that are going to be said by the other side about Obama that when you listen to them are essentially their way of saying, ooh, you know he's black. So we have to watch everything he does. Look at what he's doing. Ooh. They're going to have a microscope up to this guy because they're going to judge every little thing he does. This guy has to get it right. This guy is Jackie Robinson, for lack of a better term. He is it. He is the guy that has to get this done. And he's going to do so knowing that he has to win over the independents. It is the independents that are going to win this election for Barack Obama or are going to win this election for John McCain. Simple and straightforward. That's all it is. So you're going to have to ask yourself, if you're a little bit upset with Barack Obama and you're on the left, ask yourself this one question. What are you going to do? For this type of terminology, you've started dating the man. You're going to marry this guy in November. What are you going to do? You're going to break up with him? You're going to break up with him because of this one thing? I mean, this is like if you broke up with him, you know, you break up with somebody because, you know, they slurp their soup. You know, she's perfect. She's wonderful. She's great to be with. She makes you laugh. You feel whole inside. She slurps her soup. Ooh. Now, I don't mean to minimize the effect of FISA and what it did to the Fourth Amendment by an analogy for slurping soup. But somewhere along the line has to be that recognition that I can either marry Obama and vote for him in November, or I break it off and I date John McCain and I marry John McCain. And that's a frightening vision. I mean, do you really want to get so upset that you're going to marry John McCain? I mean, are you going to get so upset that you're going to go out and you're going to marry Ralph Nader? Come on, Ralph Nader doesn't even know that you're dating him. Ralph Nader's never known who's dating him. You know, he's right now speed dating, trying to figure out what's going on. Ralph Nader's not going to be there for you. Ralph Nader doesn't even know you're there. So what are you going to do? Break up with Obama, marry McCain, marry Nader, or are you going to stay at home playing with yourself? I think we all know what you're going to do. So, in a bad way, we're all going to forget about this in November. So, get over it. You're going to marry the man. At least I know I am. I hope he's good to me. I hope he isn't abusive, like the past man that we've all married. Not that I proposed. Not that I wanted to be with him. Oh my God, are these 8 years over yet? Oh well. Time for another Carlin bit.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the war in the Persian Gulf. Big doings in the Persian Gulf. You know my favorite part of that war? It's the first war we ever had that was on every channel plus cable. And the war got good ratings too, didn't it? Got good ratings. Well, we like war. We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. And you know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old, and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war every 20 years in this country, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Huh? Can't build a decent car, can't make a TV set or a VCR worth a fuck. Got no steel industry left, can't educate our young people, can't get health care to our old people, but we can bomb the shit out of your country, all right. Huh? We can bomb the shit out of your country, all right. Especially if your country is full of brown people. Oh, we like that, don't we? That's our hobby. That's our new job in the world, bombing brown people. Iraq, Panama, Grenada, Libya, you got some brown people in your country. Tell them to watch the fuck out, or we'll goddamn bomb them. Well, when's the last white people you can remember that we bombed? Can you remember the last white? Can you remember any white people we've ever bombed? The Germans, those are the only ones, and that's only because they were trying to cut in on our action. They wanted to dominate the world. Bullshit, that's our fucking job. That's our fucking job. Now we only bomb brown people. Not because they're trying to cut in on our action, just because they're brown. Now you probably noticed I don't feel about that war the way we were told we were supposed to feel about that war, the way we were ordered and instructed by the United States government to feel about that war. You see, I tell you, my mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do, it's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I don't just roll over when I'm told to. Sad to say, most Americans just roll over on command. Not me. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. Nothing. Zero. Nope. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country, who in the case of the Persian Gulf War were nothing more than unpaid employees of the Department of Defense, and who most of the time function as kind of an unofficial public relations agency for the United States government. So I don't listen to them, I don't really believe in my country, and I gotta tell you folks, I don't get all choked up about yellow ribbons and American flags. I consider them to be symbols, and I leave symbols to the symbol-minded. Me? I look at war a little bit differently. To me, war is a lot of prick-waving, okay? Simple thing, that's all it is. War is a whole lot of men standing out in the field waving their pricks at one another. Men are insecure about the size of their dicks, and so they have to kill one another over the idea. That's what all that asshole jock bullshit is all about. That's what all that adolescent, macho, male posturing and strutting in bars and locker rooms is all about. It's called dick fear. Men are terrified that their pricks are inadequate, and so they have to compete with one another to feel better about themselves. And since war is the ultimate competition, basically men are killing each other in order to improve their self-esteem. You don't have to be a historian or a political scientist to see the bigger dick foreign policy theory at work. It sounds like this. What? They have bigger dicks? Bomb them! And, of course, the bombs and the rockets and the bullets are all shaped like dicks. It's a subconscious need to project the penis into other people's affairs. It's called fucking with people! So, as far as I'm concerned, that whole thing in the Persian Gulf was nothing more than a big prick-waving dick fight. In this particular case, Saddam Hussein had questioned the size of George Bush's dick. And George Bush had been called a wimp for so long. Wimp rhymes with limp. George has been called a wimp for so long that he has to act out his manhood fantasies by sending other people's children to die. Even the name Bush. Even the name Bush is related to the genitals without being the genitals. A Bush is a sort of passive secondary sex characteristic. Now, if this man's name had been George Boner, well, he might have felt a little bit better about himself and we wouldn't have had any trouble over there in the first place. This whole country has a manhood problem. Big manhood problem in the USA. You can tell from the language we use. Language always gives you away. What did we do wrong in Vietnam? We pulled out. Huh? Not a very manly thing to do, is it? When you're fucking people, you gotta stay in there and fuck them good. Fuck them all the way. Fuck them till the end. Fuck them to death. Fuck them to death. Fuck them to death. Stay in there and keep fucking them until they're all dead. We left a few women and children alive in Vietnam, and we haven't felt good about ourselves since. That's why in the Persian Gulf, George Bush had to say, "This will not be another Vietnam." He actually used these words. He said, "This time we're going all the way." Imagine an American president using the sexual slang of a 13-year-old to describe his foreign policy. If you want to know what happened in the Persian Gulf, just remember the names of the two men who were running that war. Dick Cheney and Colin Powell. Somebody got fucked in the ass.
Okay, the final What a Weenie Award. This What a Weenie Award goes to Michael Smirkanich. Now, last week, while Bill O'Reilly, and as I've mentioned before, I do listen to Right Wing Radio on occasion to hear what's going on. I listen to O'Reilly because I think it's part funny and part scary. Michael Smirkanich filled in for Bill O'Reilly while Bill was on assignment, which is a nice way of saying he was on vacation. But he doesn't like to say that because he's Bill O'Reilly. And he's an everyday Joe. And he doesn't take vacations or break. He was on assignment. So Michael Smirkanich filled in for Bill O'Reilly. And here was how Michael Smirkanich started his radio show for July 2nd, 2008.
Hey everybody, it's the Radio Factor. I'm Michael Smirkanich from Philadelphia, once again with the privilege of pinch hitting for Bill. 877-9-NO-SPIN for your telephone calls on the economy, because that'll be our focus for this portion of the Radio Factor. Starbucks closing 600 stores nationwide. My specific inquiry, perception versus reality. And I'll explain in just a moment. As a matter of fact, I want to explain by offering the example of my wife, who is a realtor in the suburbs of Philadelphia, has a very successful real estate business. She's awfully frustrated, more frustrated with the media interpretation of what's gone on relative to her industry than she has been frustrated about the industry climate itself. So much so that she penned an opinion piece a couple of months ago for Philadelphia Magazine. They devoted a full page to her view, and they put a headline of what opinion she offered, which was as follows: how Matt Lauer is wrecking the Philadelphia real estate market. I want to share some of the sum and substance of that with you and try and tie it into today's economic news. My wife wrote, in any market, people are interested in the value of their home, but I've been in real estate for 24 years, and today the intensity of interest in the market is unprecedented. It's gotten so that I can't go anywhere without being buttonholed by some panicked acquaintance worried about the so-called real estate crisis. I fielded inquiries over dinner, in the line for coffee, in the frozen food section of the supermarket, and while taking the kids to the movies. I tell the curious what I know. Yes, the market has indeed softened, the local market, but it's a far cry from any crisis. The softening has nothing directly to do with the subprime market, or the availability of quality real estate, or of mortgage money. The market forces in effect here are Matt Lauer, Diane Sawyer, and those in the media. And of course, not everyone in the media has a nefarious motive, but the media-driven perception of what's going on in the marketplace has me most concerned. Let me explain. The din of network morning shows fills all of our kitchens as we hurry the kids off to school or otherwise begin our day. Inevitably, we see a plethora of so-called market experts on TV telling us the industry is in decline and the worst is yet to come. No doubt this drives ratings, but locally, there's no subprime failure to speak of. We haven't created a real estate bubble so large as to precipitate a burst. So why are we soft? Because we believe what we see on TV. I can't imagine anyone changing the channel while being told that the greatest investment that he or she will make in a lifetime is in jeopardy. There are never any exceptions offered. It's a blanket prognostication for the whole country, overlooking the deviations such as we have locally. The minute they say it, we're on our way to a self-fulfilling prophecy. First, there are the buyers. They hear about the decline in the market. They believe it must be the case everywhere. They certainly don't want to appear foolish or unsophisticated by purchasing a home at anything close to asking price, no matter how reasonable that asking price may be. So they either make ridiculously lowball offers or stay home and wait for a complete bottoming out, or until those same national experts tell them the water is warm, warm enough to jump back in. Sellers, meanwhile, are frustrated about the absence of buyers. They try the usual array of staging, sprucing up, painting, polishing, and when that fails, they bury St. Joseph in the yard. Finally, they significantly drop circumstances, relocations, and new babies and the like. They ridiculously drop their asking price to get the attention of the few buyers who have to move because of those circumstances. Prices continue to drop, but because there's been no public pronouncement that the market has recovered, homes languish on the market while buyers wait for the proverbial bottoming out. Even though there are some great values to be had. We've got good inventory, decent interest rates, and some of the lowest price points that are available in years, and still no shortage of mortgage money, even jumbo mortgages. But the sellers remain welcoming, and buyers, they're in a holding pattern because they're waiting, waiting, and waiting. Here's the conclusion. They're waiting for clearance, not from someone like me who knows their streets and deals with the market forces in the community every single day. No, they won't get in the game until somebody deemed a market expert sitting in a TV studio far away looks into a camera and tells them the crisis that never existed in their community has finally ended. And where in the world is Matt Lauer then? On to the next big story.
I had to stop it about the time that I've stopped that right now because, and I'm going to quote George Carlin here. It's like, what? Are you fucking kidding me? What? This man actually blamed the woes of the economy and based his entire argument off of an article that his wife wrote. And it was totally based on blaming Matt Lauer and Diane Sawyer and the media for what's going on with the economy. Is he out of his mind? As you know, the last I heard, it wasn't Matt Lauer that was charging me close to $5, you know, to fill up, you know, just 1 gallon of gasoline in my tank. Last time I heard, it wasn't Diane Sawyer who was borrowing money from so many different countries that our dollar has become worthless to pay for a war that's completely bankrupted this nation. You know, Diane Sawyer didn't do that. Diane Sawyer didn't destroy the value of the dollar. You know, last time I heard, it wasn't Meredith Vieira in the morning on whichever morning news show she's on being the person that was charging me, you know, close to $4 to $5 for a gallon of milk because you can't pay for it because of the amount of diesel which has gone up. It's like I heard this and just couldn't get over it because it was such a dumb way to look at how the economy is going on. So, because I feel it needs to be rebutted immediately, here is a portion from Democracy Now talking about speculation and how it has hurt the economy. And maybe, hopefully, Mr. Smith-Conishore is like, we'll just take a little bit of a listen. Here's that listen for you.
Well, let's go then to the campaign advisor to John McCain, Phil Graham, the former Texas senator. David Korn, can you talk about his significance today and in the past in this crisis?
Well, yes. I mean, Naomi gave us a great introduction, and it's a pleasure to be on a show with such an informed and intelligent voice on these matters, which often are quite complicated. But another part of the history that has led to the subprime crisis involves a sly backroom legislative maneuver mounted by Phil Graham, who was Republican chairman of the Senate Banking Committee in the 90s, and this happened actually in the end of the year 2000, and who today is a leading advisor to John McCain, co-chairman of his campaign, and mentioned as a possible Treasury Secretary should John McCain win the presidency. And what happened in 2000 was it was a painful period for some of us. It was the week that the Supreme Court was giving the election to George W. Bush. As often happens in Washington, Congress had yet to pass most of the appropriation measures that it needed to before that Congress coming to a close. And so they were lumping together, you know, 6-7 different appropriation bills into one mega bill, working all hours of the day, and no one really understanding what was and wasn't in the bill that they had to pass to keep the government going, and most people being distracted by the ongoing fight between George W. Bush and Al Gore in the Supreme Court. And in the midst of all that chaos, Senator Phil Graham slipped into this must-pass spending bill, a 268-page bill, the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, which had been kicking around for about a year. The House had passed one version of it, but there were a lot of different versions of it, and the point of it was to do a lot of different types of deregulation. It included something called the Enron loophole, which allowed Enron to sell energy futures on a deregulated basis, which helped lead to the California energy crisis the following year and the subsequent collapse of Enron. But another portion of the bill deregulated these financial instruments called swaps. These are instruments that are created by investment houses and securities firms, and they're basically bets that cover their investments. If they get them from another firm, so if an investment they have is going to go south, going to tank, they can collect on this so-called insurance policy from somebody else. The problem is that these swaps, thanks to Phil Graham's bill, are totally, totally unregulated, and the swap market is something like now about four times the size of Wall Street in terms of securities that are regulated. And it really turned a lot of the economy into a secret casino. All this action going back and forth, people betting on bets. And how this related to the subprime crisis is about this same time, you know, security firms started bundling all these bad or risky mortgages and securitizing them, and then they would sell these securities or buy them and then buy swaps or sell swaps to cover the possible loss. So it really enabled a lot of firms to go hog wild on the subprime stuff and the brokers who are doing this have no worry about losing because they were passing on the possible risks of loss to somebody else who'd never really had to have the assets to cover those losses. It was, you know, and this is all sort of taking place off the books. When UBS, which is the biggest Swiss banking company, lost, I don't know, I forget the number now, $38 billion or so in the subprime crisis, it put out an internal report for public consumption explaining how this had happened.
And they noted that it had happened in part because the securities that they lost money on, connected to these subprime loans, had been backed by their trading in swaps. So here they were saying, we were able to do this because of these unregulated swaps, which some people at this Commodity Futures Trading Commission had wanted to regulate. And it were the lobbyists who went to, the financial industry lobbyists who went to Phil Graham and said, listen, we got to have these swaps unregulated. They convinced Larry Summers, who was Treasury Secretary. They convinced Alan Greenspan. And even though the bill was pronounced dead weeks before Phil Graham did anything, he still managed to slip it through, get it passed by Congress when no one was looking, and no one even read it. You know, no one knew what was in this bill. And then the swap market took off, which helped lead to the subprime crisis. And so you think that a guy who did that and also gave us the Enron loophole would now be persona non grata in Washington and in the world of high finance. Well, if you thought that, you'd be wrong, because Phil Graham went on to become a lobbyist and a high-paid executive at UBS, that same Swiss banking firm that lost tens of billions of dollars on the subprime crisis. And as I mentioned earlier, he's in line now for a high position in a McCain administration. So, you know, you talk about failing upwards. Phil Graham is a great, you know, example of the market not working. Somebody who has failed so grandly as Phil Graham should be, you know, driven out of the market. He should be considered a bad product, laissez-faire. But instead, because he's pals with John McCain and has been for a long time, he's in line to make these mistakes and do harm to the economy and to all of us yet again.
You know, in the end, what it really comes down to is that whether it be massive speculation which has gone unregulated, the amount of borrowing that we're doing, the fact that gas prices have gone out completely out of control because of a war that has left the Middle East in complete turmoil, whether or not it's the amount of borrowing that this country has done, whether or not it's the fact that we continue to give tax breaks to companies that outsource our jobs to other nations, and we continue to lose a manufacturing base so much so that one out of every six manufacturing jobs has been lost out of the past 7 years. It doesn't matter for any of that, because it's the media's fault. It's the media's fault that when I go to fill up my tank, I'm worried as, you know, if and how much I should put in. That's the media's fault. It's the media's fault that people out there right now just can't afford to go out or are rethinking whether or not to make certain decisions. It's the media's fault that home prices are plummeting. Yeah, right. To have an argument based upon, it's not about the fact that he based it upon his wife's article. His wife might be brilliant. In fact, I'm guessing she's 10 times smarter than he is. But to base your article alone and to base any opinion alone that it has not been the failures of this administration to recognize what is happening to this country and to disavow that is just like the conservatives. On a completely different thing, one of the things I've just been stunned about, of course, when you talk about Iraq, and this is really jumping to a different subject, but they always talk about when it's time to withdraw, they say, well, you're just committed to failure. You want people, you want us to fail in Iraq. You want, the left wants failure in Iraq. You're praying for it. You want it to happen. You're like jumping for joy if this president fails. The day before the invasion, I told a friend of mine that I was going to pray that this guy was right. I wanted him to be right so badly, because anybody who had half a brain knew what it was going to mean if he was wrong. And we've all found out over the past 5 years what it has meant. It has meant 4,116 deaths, over 30,000 casualties. Depending on the reports you read, between 500,000 to 1,000,000 dead Iraqis. It has meant turmoil in the Middle East that has affected markets all over the world. That is not media driven. Those are just the facts. The right always worries and claims about what it is that the left is so fearful and how the root for a failure that has already occurred. Nobody rooted for this. Nobody wants it. I don't ever read these global warming update stories because I'm hoping, you know, woohoo, I'm right about this subject. Now, I read it because it's frightening about this subject. And it's the same thing with the left. They talk about these things and these failures and other things that occur because they want people to wake up and try to fix the problem. It is what has to occur. The right continuously talks about the so-called cheerleading on the left for failure, but the right fails to even recognize one thing that they have failed on. And there are so many things, and they won't recognize them because they're being led by a man who couldn't point out his failures any faster than he can point out where the lower Ninth Ward is, lest we forget the 2004 debates. It is human to recognize our errors. It's cold and heartless not to even recognize when we've hurt others. And that's what amazes me about this. And for Michael Smirkanich and his ilk to go around putting the blame on what is hurting people onto the media like it's a false story, like it doesn't exist, that the prices of homes are falling, that people can't even look upon the equity that they've built, that it's collapsed and gone away on them. Because of all the factors I've just previously discussed, and to say that that's Matt Lauer's fault, well, that's not just idiotic. It's cold, and it's heartless, and it's what makes him the second winner of this What a Weenie Award.
Dempsey's Department Store is offering a complete line of cheap crap you don't need at extremely high prices. Come in today and be treated rudely by our poorly trained clerks. Remember, at Dempsey's, we're not just talking about inflation, we're doing something about it. We're raising our prices. Get one now. Everybody has one. They're almost gone. They're portable, lightweight, easy to use, collapsible, convenient, and guaranteed. Get one now. The new Super Jumbo Deluxe. Handy, pre-wrapped designer colors and available in all sizes. Get one now. They won't rust, tarnish, blister, crack, or peel, but they might kill you. On Saturday morning, it's Adventure Time. Don't miss Frontier, the story of 30 people who brave bitter weather, loneliness, disease, starvation, and hostile Indians to reach Utah, only to find they don't like it there. Then it's Ranger Dan and his big dog Dick, or Ranger Dan and his big dog Dick. And now an announcement from the National Apple Institute.
Fuck pears.
Well, I'm going to end this on by airing one of my favorite Carlin bits. It's about euphemisms, and I encourage you to listen.
I don't like words that hide the truth. I don't like words that conceal reality. I don't like euphemisms or euphemistic language. And American English is loaded with euphemisms because Americans have a lot of trouble dealing with reality. Americans have trouble facing the truth. So they invent a kind of a soft language to protect themselves from it. And it gets worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat. Most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables, shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time, and the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language. That language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. I'll give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. Medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. Car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining. And constipation became occasional irregularity. When I was a little kid, if I got sick, they wanted me to go to the hospital and see the doctor. Now they want me to go to a health maintenance organization or a wellness center to consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. They're fucking broke. Because a lot of them were fired. You know, fired. Management wanted to curtail redundancies in the human resources area. So many people are no longer viable members of the workforce. Smug, greedy, well-fed white people have invented a language to conceal their sins. It's as simple as that. The CIA doesn't kill anybody anymore. They neutralize people. Or they depopulate the area. The government doesn't lie. It engages in disinformation. The Pentagon actually measures nuclear radiation in something they call sunshine units. Israeli murderers are called commandos. Arab commandos are called terrorists. Contra killers are called freedom fighters. Well, if crime fighters fight crime and firefighters fight fire, what do freedom fighters fight? They never mention that part of it to us, do they? Never mention that part of it. And... and some of this stuff is just silly. We all know that. Like on the airlines, they say they want a pre-board. Well, what the hell is pre-board? What does that mean? To get on before you get on? They say they're going to pre-board those passengers in need of special assistance. Cripples! Simple, honest, direct language. There's no shame attached to the word cripple that I can find in any dictionary. No shame attached to it. In fact, it's a word used in Bible translations. Jesus healed the cripples. Doesn't take seven words to describe that condition. But we don't have any cripples in this country anymore. We have the physically challenged. Is that a grotesque enough evasion for you? How about differently abled? I've heard them called that. Differently abled. You can't even call these people handicapped anymore. They'll say, we're not handicapped. We're handicapable. These poor people have been bullshitted by the system into believing that if you change the name of the condition, somehow you'll change the condition. Well, hey, cousin, doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. We have no more deaf people in this country. Hearing impaired. No one's blind anymore, partially sighted or visually impaired. We have no more stupid people. Everybody has a learning disorder. Or he's minimally exceptional. How would you like to be told that about your child? He's minimally exceptional. Oh, thank God for that. Psychologists actually have started calling ugly people those with severe appearance deficits. It's getting so bad that any day now I expect to hear a rape victim referred to as an unwilling sperm recipient. You know? And we have no more old people in this country. No more old people. We shipped them all away, and we brought in these senior citizens. Isn't that a typically American 20th century phrase? Bloodless. Lifeless. No pulse in one of them. A senior citizen. But I've accepted that one. I've come to terms with it. I know it's here to stay. We'll never get rid of it. That's what they're going to be called, so I'll relax on that. But the one I do resist, the one I keep resisting, is when they look at an old guy and they'll say, look at him, Dan. He's 90 years young. Imagine the fear of aging that reveals. To not even be able to use the word old to describe someone, to have to use an antonym. And fear of aging is natural, it's universal, isn't it? We all have that. No one wants to get old, no one wants to die, but we do. So we bullshit ourselves. I started bullshitting myself when I got to my 40s. As soon as I was in my 40s, I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, well, I guess I'm getting older. Older sounds a little better than old, doesn't it? Sounds like it might even last a little longer. Bullshit, I'm getting old. And it's okay, because thanks to our fear of death in this country, I won't have to die. I'll pass away. Or I'll expire like a magazine subscription. If it happens in the hospital, they'll call it a terminal episode. The insurance company will refer to it as negative patient care outcome. And if it's the result of malpractice, they'll say it was a therapeutic misadventure. I'm telling you, some of this language makes me want to vomit. Well, maybe not vomit. Makes me want to engage in an involuntary personal protein spill.
Well, that's going to be it for podcast number 30 of Indirect Democracy. I'd like to thank you all for taking the time to listen. Thank you all for listening to a very clip-heavy and long episode of Indirect Democracy. I'd also like to thank Matt Bloodwell and the guys at Megaphone for allowing me to use their music, Not Your Enemy, from the album For Crying Out Loud. You can find their music at myspace.com/megaphone or through their homepage at www.megaphonemusic.net. And, of course, you can also find their links to the homepage for Indirect Democracy. But before I close this out, so usually at the end of the music, I usually have a little statement. Well, I'm going to put one last little George Carlin bit, and I encourage you to listen to it. But as I end, I want to thank you all for listening. I encourage you to stay tuned. There will be more episodes coming up, different subjects. I'll figure out where to start from there. But I'd like to end this all by saying one last thing. We have lost some great people over the past month or so. George Carlin, and I know a lot of people might get a little bit, oh my goodness, but Tim Russert was a big loss. Now, I used to watch him every Sunday for the past 7 years, and his loss was important. And he could get me mad and infuriated all at the same time while I was intrigued and listened, and I could be 1 week saying, yeah, go get him, and the next week, oh my God, what's wrong with you? And I realized an important thing, that was the great job of what he did, because he always had a way of making you think about what he was saying and where the question went. And even though I wanted him to follow up in some ways, what he was able to do and where he was able to go and to confront some people and get things done, that was an admirable thing. So he will be missed, and I know I will miss him. But for those of you who are going, oh, he was just a right-wing tool and all this, you know what? There are other people to get more upset about that are out there currently right now, and other people that have passed away that are very much worth vilifying. I speak of Jesse Helms in particular. So maybe next time somebody does pass away, recognize where it is that should have a little bit of priority in vilifying somebody. But it was very touching, and there were times when listening to Keith Olbermann alone, I kind of wanted to cry at the loss of his friend. God bless Timmy Russert, and God bless George Carlin. So, or as he would say, Joe bless you, but that's another bit. And I encourage you to go listen to some of his other bits. Buy some of his albums, go out there and listen to the genius that was George Carlin. But for now, we're going to end out this episode, and I ask you just to take care of each other, and bye for now. Yeah.
I think we're part of a greater wisdom than we will ever understand. A higher order. Call it what you want. You know what I call it? The big electron. The big electron. Whoa. 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 It doesn't punish. It doesn't reward. It doesn't judge at all. It just is. And so are we. For a little while. Thanks for being here with me for a little while tonight. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Take care of yourself. Take care of yourself. And take care of somebody else. Thank you. Good night.